From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today we explore modern music. Singer-songwriter Sid Straw talks about her new album, Pink Velour.
That buzzkill chick is back after 12 years, and she sounds depressed.
And we'll find out how the East Village Opera Company breathes new life into opera's greatest hits. Also, Ben Ratliff tells us what he learned about Ornette Coleman and other jazz legends when he sat down and listened to music with them.
You can get very mystical talking about sound and human expression, but look, that is what music is all about. That is why we respond to a piece of music, not because somebody is playing a D, but because the way they play a D.
Alex Ross is the music critic for The New Yorker. He's also the author of The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. Ross weaves together the events of the 20th century and its music in this national bestseller and Pulitzer Prize finalist. Alex Ross told Anne Strainchamps how modern music continues to make its presence felt in rock music.
We Will Rock You by Queen seems to take its principal melody and its kind of stamping, thump-thump rhythm from a little section of Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. The evidence is pretty strong. It would be a big stretch if this were mere coincidence. And it's a very famous piece. The Fanfare for the Common Man has been heard, at halftime and stadiums and sports arenas and amusement parks. I remember hearing it when I was 10 or 12 at King's Dominion Amusement Park in Virginia. So it's something that most people have encountered at some point or another, but, who was Aaron Copland and what was the course of his career and what happened to him? That's a story that's not so well known.
You know 20th century music so well. Do you hear these sorts of echoes all the time?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, are there other notable examples that come to mind?
Sure. I mean, sometimes there's this direct influence on, the sounds of movies and, even political campaign commercials. I mean, you hear those Copland sounds there quite a bit. Sometimes also it's more, these composers, especially in the early 20th century, they just kind of threw so many sounds out there, these kind of radical new combinations of tones that people hadn't thought of in the same way that the painters broke away from representative painting to abstraction. And Joyce and Gertrude Stein and T.S. Eliot started, arranging words in new combinations. That's what the composers did. And so the idea kind of goes out there and floats around and then sort of enters the culture in other ways. So, in jazz, as jazz goes along, you start to hear much more dissonant chords and sort of tonality is being played around with. And there was some direct, some indirect influence from the classical avant-garde in that way. And the same thing happens, at the end of the 60s when the Beatles started listening to John Cage and Karlheinz Stockhaus and other, very advanced composers of the day. And
so can you hear John Cage or Stockhausen in Beatles songs?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think starting with Tomorrow Never Knows, those tape loops, those sped up sounds, those kind of shrieking, shrill little kind of electronic voices.
Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. It is not dying. It is not dying.
They sound a whole lot like passages of a famous electronic piece by Stockhausen, Song of the Youths, and also John Cage's habit of sort of taking little bits and pieces of tape and splicing them together in a surreal collage. That also goes into the Beatles' Revolution 9. So it's all there. I mean, the Beatles, saw this as a sort of great storehouse of sounds that they could use.
So why do you think audiences are willing to accept some of the hallmarks of 20th century music, dissonance and atonality, for instance, in popular music, in Beatles songs, when they're not willing to sit through concerts of it?
That's a very big question. I mean, the whole book, you know, repeatedly throughout the book, I grapple with that problem. I mean, somehow when people walk into the concert hall, their minds narrow a bit and their expectations become constricted, and they kind of want to walk into another age. They want to go back in time. They don't necessarily want to confront new sounds and new ideas. And this is kind of a long-standing, deeply ingrained habit with American concert-going audiences, especially going back more than 100 years. I mean, you look at concert programs in the late 19th century, and you don't see a lot of new pieces. And even back then, when Tchaikovsky and Dvorak and Verdi and Brahms were still alive, there was resistance to the new. You see this also in Europe, too. Sort of the proportion of new pieces on programs keeps dropping from decade to decade as the 19th century goes on. So it's this idea the concert hall needs to be a refuge, it needs to be a kind of a place where you escape into the past. And that's wonderful up to a point. But after a point, it does start to stifle creativity and really put obstacles in the way of the living composers.
You know, I don't know. It seems to me that you're suggesting that the problem lies with audiences who just aren't sufficiently up to date to appreciate modern music. But couldn't you argue that the problem with a great deal of contemporary music is that all that atonality, all that dissonance, I know there are people who suggest that, in fact, our brains simply aren't wired to appreciate music that's organized this way, that, you know, our brains are set up to appreciate tonal music, and that there's something not natural about some of this music for us. It can be an acquired taste, and we can acquire it, but it doesn't come naturally.
Right. I mean, I grant that problem. I do think at times in the 20th century, composers have gone to extremes where, you know, of course they have the right to do whatever they want, but, you know, they shouldn't be surprised when audiences have a lot of trouble with it, and they shouldn't necessarily blame the audiences. And what I'm pointing out in the 19th century is this resistance to the new really comes into play long before atonality is a factor. You know, when Tchaikovsky is writing, when Brahms is writing these pieces that are now universally popular, back then, audiences were saying, we don't want to hear a lot of this new music. We want to hear Mozart and Beethoven. So I'm saying, you know, this is a kind of a habit that audiences fell into before the 20th century of resisting the new.
We should talk about some of the music itself. Do you have in your head kind of top five list of pieces you really wish were performed more and that you wish you could introduce people to?
Well, I mean, of course, there are 20th century pieces that are played nearly as often as anything from the 18th and 19th century. I mean, the Rite of Spring, Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. There are other pieces that maybe aren't quite so well known but have an extraordinary effect on people once they encounter them.
Like what?
The Quartet from the End of Time by Olivier Messiaen. This is a piece, some parts of which are quite challenging in terms of the harmony and rhythm. There are other movements that are just extraordinarily, ethereally beautiful that, you know, very few people can resist. It's a wonderful piece through which to really get acquainted with the whole 20th century, because there's so many different things going on, this purely tonal music and this quite dissonant, sort of rhythmically complex music all kind of crunched together. So that's a great piece to start with. I think Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes is another truly great piece of music that's certainly made headway in opera houses around the world. It was first played in 1945, still not as well known as it should be. One of the greatest operas ever written, one of the most intense, overwhelming psychological dramas that any composer has ever created.
The bridge is down, we have swam over, and your heart, is it seaworthy?
Tell me more about that particular piece.
You know, Britten grew up on the east coast of England near this little town called Aldborough, where there was this old story about a fisherman who went mad and brutalized his apprentices and was hounded by the village and died. And Britten created an opera out of this rather ghastly story that just pulls in so many aspects of operatic language and these great choruses in the style of Verdi's and Mussorgsky's most magnificent choruses. This really interior psychological writing for his hero, his anti-hero, this wonderful orchestral depiction of the sea and this barren, beautiful landscape around Aldeburgh. So it's an opera sort of quite unlike any written before it, and it has that great connection to tradition.
What about John Cage? He's a composer whom you describe him as the most revolutionary 20th century composer.
He's one of certainly the most revolutionary. I mean, Cage is a composer that a lot of people talk about and have never really heard that much. You know, he sort of threw so many ideas out there that sort of people are still coping with it and sort of taking it all in. He kind of... You know, I mean, if you look at when he came along in the 1930s and 1940s, he was working alongside the abstract expressionist painters in New York and also poets like the young John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara. And he was just all about freedom. He was about saying sort of anything is possible. You know, let's sort of reject the tradition completely and just experiment in every imaginable direction. And, you know, just as Jackson Pollock, you know, started, you know, throwing paint around the canvas in this very free, wild fashion, Cage was doing the same thing with notes and letting music be subject to chance. And, you know, a lot of people will say, well, this is nonsense, you know, when they first encounter it. But, you know, this idea of freedom had a great effect, sort of unexpected effect on all different composers. There are individual pieces by Cage which are actually extremely beautiful in a surprisingly quiet, subtle way. His pieces for prepared piano, where he sort of inserted screws and little pieces of wood and various other objects between the strings and created this weird, fabulous new percussion instrument, tuned percussion instrument out of the piano. So Cage was so important and so liberating. And, you know, when people looked at Pollock for the first time, too, they thought this is nonsense. You know, and now Pollock's paintings go for $100 million on the art market. So attitudes can change and, you know, tastes can be acquired.
Alex Ross, he's the author of the critically acclaimed book The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. He's also the music critic for The New Yorker. Russ spoke with Ann Strainchamps. So what do you think? Do you like to revisit the classics? Or are you always listening for new sounds? We'd love to know. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to Alex Ross's website. Peter Kiesewalter and Tylee Ross met 7 years ago when they were both hired to work on a film about opera. Kiesewalter is an arranger and multi-instrumentalist. Ross is a vocalist. The two decided to form the East Village Opera Company, a band that gives opera's greatest hits an extreme musical makeover, reimagining them as popular songs. So it's fair to say that their new album, Old School, was 300 years in the making.
Dort und Verzweiflung, dort und Verzweiflung flammen um mich her. Fühlt mich durch dich, Zahar oder Schmerzen.
Rock and opera don't seem to have much in common, but actually they do, don't they?
I think they do. For one, they're both popular music forms of their time, but also when you look at it from a strictly emotional and a spectacle point of view, they're very similar. They're populist art forms, and they're both rather large. And when I say rock, I'm sort of referencing the sort of early 70s arena rock, which was not a subtle art form.
And opera isn't exactly a subtle art form either, is it?
No, not really. But, you know, the concept itself of playing old music on new instruments is as old as music is. It's really not that radical a concept. I mean, it's what American music is based on, the interpretation or reinterpretation of the songs of, you know, Tin Pan Alley and the blues and jazz. Just to my knowledge, it hadn't really been done that much with what has become European art music, or at least not very successfully, in my opinion.
What do you do? We talk about this as though everybody knows. How do you go about transforming opera into rock?
It's very simple. You throw a score away, and you start with the lyric and the melody. And if you can play it around a campfire with an acoustic guitar or on an accordion, you have a good song there. And that's why these songs are still around these days. At the very heart, there's a great song. And then we begin from there. What does this song, or what does this aria remind us of? What is the libretto about? What is the opera about? Does it remind us of any song from the last 50 to 100 years of popular music? Perhaps we can cross-reference them. It just starts from there. But the singer sitting right in front of me here, the aria has to resonate with Tylee and Anne-Marie, who's the female singer in this, and they have to feel that they can sing it and own the song, as opposed to doing their best to wrap their tongues around the gnarly Italian and French and German words, you know.
Yeah. Tylee, there was a story in the Washington Post that said that opera crossovers are becoming a cottage industry these days, but there's something different about you, markedly different, in fact, I think they said. What is it you think that makes the East Village Opera Company so different from the rest of what's going on?
Well, I can only guess, but from my observation, it seems like most of the cottage industry is more of something that's coming out of the record industry. It's a lot of people out there who are looking at demographics of who's buying records, and A&R people thinking, hey, let's feed this and let's find a couple beautiful girls or good-looking guys to sing this opera stuff. And then you call it a crossover opera because it's not really legitimate opera. And it's actually manufactured by a record company or by a production company. The way we started was that we were actually, I mean, it started through the strange beginning with this film, but the reason that we kept going was because we loved it, and it was actually being generated by the musicians, and we really felt like we had a lot of freedom to take this wherever we wanted and to personalize it and to make it our own. So we never really felt like we were feeding into some classical crossover thing. In fact, our first album was out before I even knew that there was such a genre. I didn't think that there was a genre for this. I thought we were creating our own thing.
Well, you can certainly hear the original in all of these, although some more than others, I guess it's obvious. Maybe we ought to talk about one, and I guess that the logical place to start is at the top. Peter, can you kind of help me through what you did with the work that you call The Ride? It's based on Wagner's Die Walküre.
Right. When we first started, there was one composer who I thought, there's nothing we can possibly do. You know, it's so intimidating. And that's the music of Wagner, who's, along with Verdi, one of the two titans of 19th century opera. But we were never ones to shy away from the hits or the obvious. And it was an idea I had brewing in my head for a number of years before finally trying to tackle it. And that was to play that instrumental, that famous instrumental piece, The Ride of the Valkyries, as if Led Zeppelin were playing it.
Hail, hail, gods of war, tell us what we're fighting for. Hands on tight, hands on clean, hands that hit the coal machine.
I thought it would be interesting to tell the story of what happens in this magnificent piece of music. So we took three or four of the leitmotifs from the last, hour and a half or so of the Valkyries and put a little mini opera together. And Tylee and Anne-Marie wrote words sort of explaining the arc of the relationship, what happens in that last dramatic hour of the opera.
Tylee, you're the lead singer of the group, the lead male singer anyway. Do you have a favorite vocal performance on this album?
God, you're asking me to toot my own horn? I'll toot Annie's. I think Casta Diva, well, actually, and we call it As You Were Then, is an extraordinarily beautiful, understated performance. I think it's gorgeous.
Casta Diva, Casta Diva, que
she has a beautiful voice and has made this very appealing. That one is from Bellini, from Norma.
Yeah, from Norma.
I got the impression, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, that she's more comfortable with the other languages than you are.
It's funny.
Was that a nasty thing to say?
No. The exact opposite is true. Tylee actually can speak French, and Tylee's the one who actually has to coach Annie in terms of Italian diction.
Well, my apologies then.
No, it's okay. But my feeling about it is that, I mean, we've actually had operatic coaches, dialect coaches, to coach us on this. I feel very comfortable actually steering away from some of the correct pronunciation in order to Americanize it, which just makes it sound more like pop music. If you embrace some of the operatic vowel shapes that these songs are traditionally sung with, it stops sounding or feeling like pop music to me. So I embrace an Americanized kind of pronunciation of this stuff, and I do my best to not, you know, slap the face of the language directly.
Yeah. Can you give me an example from this disc of where that was more important to you than another?
Well, the butterfly duet. In Italian, they would say butterfly, and we sing butterfly. I mean, the word is butterfly, not butterfly. A lot of opera singers, the best of them too, Maria Callas, if you would hear her speak what she sang in terms of pronunciation, it's an aberration of the language. They make unnatural sounds because at that range of their voice, or what, it depends on what particular note or where it sits in their range, they have to completely change the vowel in order to be heard above a 72-piece orchestra. It's one thing that a lot of purists will scoff at, but we have the benefit of using microphones. We don't have to project acoustically. We can take a much more linguistically natural approach in terms of pronouncing the French and Italian.
I'm curious about another of the songs, the Handel's Semele, the piece you called Walk. It seems to me that it's a very subtle piece, but it's also more subtly opera than the others. It more soulful in a way, I suppose. Tell me, either one of you, what went into the creation of that one?
I think we should mention that for a few years we'd played the opening night gala of New York City Opera, and they had asked us to do something from their upcoming season. And it's an opera company that's known for their productions of Handel operas, and they were doing Semele that year. So we did the obvious hit, which is the one aria from that opera that everyone knows, Where Ere You Walk. And we did another one as well, but with Where Ere You Walk, contemporizing Baroque music is, I find, very, very difficult, much harder than music from the later eras, in that there's less repetition. It's the exact opposite of what popular music is, which is different words but repeating music. Sonata form had not been invented yet in the Baroque era, so you'll find that the sections just keep wandering, but in fact they're singing the same words over and over again. So we thought, first and foremost, why don't we write another verse, we called one section a verse, and expand upon what we think the theme of that particular aria was, and then did our best to straighten out harmonically what was going on without compromising the melody at all or the general harmonic outline that panel had worked on. Keep in mind that it was well over 250 years old, and a lot of music history has happened since then. And we used, you know, late 60s Motown as an initial template and added some Motown horns and some Hammond B3 organ, and Tiley wrote some extra words and was off to the races.
The East Village Opera Company with their version of Walk from Handel's Semele. It's from the group's new album, Old School. Peter Kiesewalter is the East Village Opera Company's arranger and multi-instrumentalist. Tiley Ross is the group's vocalist. Coming up, Ben Ratliff tells us what he learned from listening to music with 15 living jazz legends as we continue our Hour on Modern Music. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Ben Ratliff has been a jazz critic at the New York Times since 1996. He's also the author of a new book called The Jazz Ear, Conversations Over Music. After 10 years, Ratliff became tired of doing the traditional interview in which he asks jazz musicians about their new albums or concerts. As he told Steve Paulson,
I never come away from those kinds of conversations with a sense of who this person really is. And my question is how they hear. I mean, you know, ultimately I want to know how their brain works, right? But I can't, you know, get into it. But I want to know how they hear and what they listen for. And the best way to do that seemed to be to sit down with them and listen to music together with them, but not music that they had played on.
Well, let's talk about some of the musicians you sat down and listened to music with. Say the guitarist Pat Metheny. What made you want to talk with him?
Well, he's an exception to this general rule about musicians, you know, preferring not to think analytically. He does, I think, have an analytical mind, and he is incredibly bright and insightful and sort of speaks in complete paragraphs, you know. Part of this is because he came along and became very important in the mid-70s, just as the jazz education movement was really starting. And I think he has always been a kind of hero in the jazz education movement. So he's done lots and lots of clinics and lectures, and he knows what his issues are. You know, he knows what musical qualities are really important to him and so forth. So he came to this thing more prepared than anybody. He had a list of songs he wanted to talk about for very specific reasons. He wanted to listen to Glenn Gould playing Bach for reasons of touch. He wanted to listen to a Wes Montgomery solo from the early 60s for reasons of improvised structure.
Well, and another one you talk about is All the Things You Are, a 1963 recording by Sonny Rollins and Coleman Hawkins.
Yeah, that's what he wanted to start with. And it wasn't so much for Sonny Rollins and Coleman Hawkins, but for Paul Bley, who was the piano player on that record. Because Pat feels that that particular solo was sort of like the shot heard around the world when jazz musicians could start from the information that was there, the chords of the song, and then blast off into
a whole new area of improvisation that wasn't, you know, abstract and wasn't aggressive necessarily, aggressive for its own sake. It was almost like folk-like, you know, it operated within its own logic, and it's very bold. Anyway, he had a lot of fascinating things to say about why this solo, for him, was sort of like the beginning of everything, you know, the Big Bang.
Now, you had a totally different kind of encounter, I get the sense, with the sax player and composer Ornette Coleman, who sounds like quite a character.
Well, Ornette's a very original thinker, and he doesn't necessarily answer musical questions the way you would expect to have them answered. He generally answers with another question of his own. He usually brings it back to his own obsessions, which are sometimes musical, sometimes absolutely musical, you know, music theoretical. But they're also philosophical. He's in a sort of perpetual state of bother about what happens when you name something, you know, like what happens when you set up a system such as Western harmony and you say, well, these are the rules and I'm going to call it something. And it gets into sort of biblical issues about naming, you know, like naming, like creation and naming, and this is this. This is now this for this purpose and it can't be anything else. And this kind of thing frustrates Ornette endlessly, and he's kind of like puzzling over it all the time.
I could imagine that maybe he wouldn't like the idea of having to pick out a few songs that had been especially influential for him.
Well, he loves music. He doesn't like being pressed into choosing particular things. He said, you know, I'll listen to anything. We had to narrow it down, you know, so I said, well, you know, how about some gospel music? And he said, sure, absolutely. And I had some other ideas, you know, Charlie Parker, John Coltrane. He said, sure, whatever. The one thing that he did suggest, which, you know, I hadn't seen coming at all, was a cantorial record. Somebody I had barely heard of, but who, you know, if you are a Jewish person, maybe you grew up in New York, you know, if you're over 70, you probably have heard of this person.
Is it Joseph Rosenblatt?
Joseph Rosenblatt, a cantor born in Ukraine who came to New York in 1911. And Ornette responded to this Joseph Rosenblatt record very emotionally. Ornette has this theory that we shouldn't think of notes as notes per se. We shouldn't think of a D as just a D. The person who is creating the supposed D and the note itself together form some kind of harmony. This is the way he thinks. So, you know, when he listens to Joseph Rosenblatt sing this very emotional song.
And this was something that was recorded, what, back in 1916 or something like that?
Yeah, thereabouts. So when he hears Rosenblatt singing this song, he thinks, are those really notes, you know, or are they not notes at all? Is this just pure Joseph Rosenblatt singing sounds that you can't define? It would take a lot longer than this interview to explain where Ornette is coming from. But it was an interesting conversation because once I had transcribed the interview, I kept understanding new things about what he said, reading it over for the second and third and fourth and fifth times. And I still do. He's a very curious guy.
Hmm. He really was interested in pure improvisation. I mean, if that's possible. But I mean, but that's clearly what he's going for.
See, you're getting at his train of thought. I mean, he is interested in this idea of pure improvisation that can't be quantified, that can't be defined by key. Yes, he loves the word sound, and he loves the word idea. And he does talk about music with a certain amount of rigor. You know, he talks about key and he talks about notes, but that's just sort of a formality. What he's really interested in is sound, and what he's really interested in is, you know, human expression. You know, you can get very mystical talking about sound and human expression, but look, that is what music is all about. That is why we respond to a piece of music, not because somebody is playing a D, but because, you know, the way they play a D and what they bring to it.
But it's almost as if someone like Ornette Coleman is trying to take music to another level. It's almost as if talking about music as if it's not music, as if it's something else, as if it's some expression, some elemental force in the universe.
You mean, and not just entertainment?
Yeah, I mean, maybe even not just art either.
Or something to be bought and sold.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, sure. I think what, at a couple times when I tried to break down what he was saying into sort of ordinary musical terms, he would say, okay, yeah, but, you know, the way you're talking, you're just paying the bills. You know, he's drawing a distinction between, you know, sort of formality and the real meaning of existence, if you want to put it that way. He has a great look. What he says, the way he expresses things is very poetic and incredibly funny too. I mean, I tell a story in this book that a little bit after I did this interview with him, he won a Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award, and he went to Los Angeles to receive the award. And he gave this speech, which is the most fantastic work of poetry and tautology that I've ever seen. You know, it has to do with life and death and all this kind of stuff. And then he had to do some very light interviews with some, you know, TV news people or whatever who said, "So, Ornette Coleman, what's the achievement in your life that you're proudest of?" And he looked at the interviewer and he said, "Well, to answer that question, I'd have to go way, way back. In fact, I'd have to go back to the moment when you asked me that question." And, you know, the interview stopped then.
Ornette Coleman's Sleep Talking from his Pulitzer Prize-winning album Sound Grammar. Ben Ratliff is the author of The Jazz Ear, Conversations Over Music. He spoke with Steve Paulson. If you have questions or comments about the show, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll meet indie singer-songwriter Sid Straw as we conclude our Hour on Modern Music. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Sid Straw is an indie singer-songwriter. She's released two critically acclaimed albums over the years. But Straw is probably best known for her work with other musicians, including Van Dyke Parks, T-Bone Burnett, and R.E.M.'s Michael Stipe. Sid Straw has just released her first new album in 12 years, called Pink Velour. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon talked to Straw about the new album, starting with the title track, Pink Velour.
I went home again just to prove that you could. I went home again and it looked pretty good. Flora and fauna, how I have missed you.
Pink Velour is one of the most autobiographical songs Sid Straw has ever written.
It's the compacted life story of our troubled family. It's the American dream gone horribly awry.
Into the rain, which turned to snow. Modern wagon train. Westward ho, jump in the back, wear your blue dress, and pack the pink velour. We'll save our best for when we get there. Have to try.
Straw has described it as her family story in one song.
Mom kept leaving for her own reasons that she's not here to talk about. As a kid, you know, it doesn't matter what you're going through, you just want your parents to be together. It doesn't matter the level of happiness in the home or what's happening. I think the kids just want something that they can define as a family. I bounced around a lot between parents. I think that's also quite common. It wasn't that common in 1746 when I was growing up. It wasn't that common. Or if it was, it wasn't really talked about much.
Please don't take away my pretty dreams. They are all I have.
I was at McCabe's guitar shop in Santa Monica, California. My mother was there, and I had just finished the song. And she used to come to the shows, and if I would get out of hand or cuss or say anything too blue, she would try to edit me by shining a big flashlight on me up on stage. I would see the flashlight of anger, the remorse code, I used to call it, because she would flash it using the remorse code. I miss her flashing me with that thing. So I sang the song, and I got pretty torn up. It's always such an event to sing a song for the first time anyhow, and this song being so close to my bones. It was kind of beautiful and painful, but I got through it. I don't generally dissolve into tears in the middle of a song, but I did that night, and so did my mother.
Well, Mom and Dad and my big brother Pete, my sister Sally and I ride all down the highway.
Another very poignant song on the Pink Velour album is called About to Forget. What inspired this one?
After my mother died, my dog, Henry, pictured in the CD, he was so in love with my mother. She spoiled him rotten. And he really took note of that. And for 3 weeks, at least, after my mother died, he sat next to her big flowery chair that she used to compose all her children's stories and just direct her world from this chair in Southern California. And he sat obediently waiting for her to come back. And one day I was sitting in her chair wrapping up some of her affairs, and I looked down at him and he was still waiting for her, and I just thought of the first line of the song. It's hard to explain heavy things to a dog. And it just unfolded.
It's hard to explain heavy things to a dog, but one day you'll sleep like a log. It's hard to explain heavy things to a pup. One day you'll sleep and you won't wake up. And it kills me in advance, my dear. It just kills me.
The album also features Straw's version of the Neil Young classic, Harvest. What made her choose to sing that song?
I sometimes almost feel as though that song decided to sing me. I love Neil so much. I love Neil way too much. I think that Neil Young is the one thing that I can't do without. Of course, Air and Water is good, but Neil is better.
Did I see you down in the young man's town? With your mother in so much pain, I was almost there at the top of the stairs with her screaming in the rain. Did she wake you up to tell you that it was only a change of
makes Sid Straw's music unique? Cultural critic Greil Marcus says it best. Marcus wrote, quote, "What makes Straw her own woman in the pop game is her ability not simply to summon or project emotion, but to create characters, act them out, build suspense, and shock you with what a character who's been holding back has now dumped in your lap," end quote. Which is not surprising, since Straw's parents were actors and she's done some acting. I was curious to know how she so fully inhabits the narrators of her songs.
I honestly try not to interfere with the emotional context of what I'm trying to do. I try not to get in my own way. I'm trying to sing really simply in a complex, overburdened world. I don't have any special tricks. I just take a deep breath and I listen to what I'm doing. I think I'm a bit of a method singer. I really pay attention to what I'm saying, whether I wrote it or whoever wrote it.
Hey, remember?
That's CBGB's from Straw's previous album, War and Peace, which came out in 1996. You can really hear the power and beauty of Sid Straw's voice in her version of Blue Shadows on the Trail from the 1988 Disney tribute album, Stay Awake.
Shades of night are falling,
As the wind begins to sigh and the world is silhouetted against the sky,
singer-songwriter Sid Straw. She spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. Straw's new album is called Pink Velour. You can find a link to her website on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 112B, Modern Music. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.